Martin Horsewell is currently product manager for television transmission at Gates Air in Mason, Ohio. Mr. Horsewell has been employed in the broadcast industry for 43 years, starting with the Independent Broadcasting Authority in the United Kingdom in 1974. As a transmitter maintenance engineer, his move to Harris Broadcast Division in 1980 was the start of a long career that has paved the way to his current role, including numerous positions in service, engineering, sales support, and product management. Mr. Horsewell has participated and presented at major broadcast conferences worldwide and has authored numerous publications and technical papers. Ladies and gentlemen, Martin Horsewell.
Can you hear me okay? Can you hear me? Okay, thank you. So I'm a little closer to the mic. Hang on. I've got a mic here. Sorry. He's got it. I'm trying to forward the slide, but it hasn't moved yet. So today I'm going to discuss basically what do you need to do at your transmitter facility, your transmitter site, to go from HSC 1 to HSC 3. You know, we'd like to think it's a really easy thing to do. You just push a button and you can switch from one modulation to the other. But in reality, there's a few differences between the modulations you have to think about. Christine mentioned some of those this morning. Peak to average power ratio is one. How much power do I need is another good question. I'll try to answer that the best way I can. Beyond the transmitter, which is the part we manufacture, there are other components at your transmitter facility, such as line, patch panels, test loads, filters, antennas, and so forth. And Christine's covered the antennas and filters quite a bit, so I won't spend a lot of time on that. Then I want to look at some transition scenarios. How can you actually start running 3.0 while you're still on the air with one HSC 1? It's not that simple. And what do I do to plan ahead? So moving right along. So here's an obvious difference between the two modulations. These are two constellations. The one on the left is HSC 1, 8VSB, you're quite familiar with, eight levels. You can see the modulation on there. If I go to HSC 3, there are actually dozens and dozens of potential modulation constellations that you can get, depending on the modulation that you select. It's a very open standard in terms of what the customer or the user can use to adjust the parameters depending on what you need to use the HSC 3 signal to do. You know, you can have very high data rates with less robustness versus low data rates. And I'll get to more of that later. You notice that particular constellation is called a non-uniform constellation, or NUC, as it would be abbreviated. And that varies depending on things like code rates. For instance, if I change the code rate even on that 256 QAM, the constellation changes completely. So here are three HSCs. HSC 1 on the left, that's what you're used to today. It's been running in this country for something like 20 years now. It's how time flies very quickly. Basically, it allows you one set of parameters. You have one data rate, 19.39 megabits per second. You can use that to transmit audio, video, data. But you still have to, you know, per FCC rules, you still have to transmit your television station's programming over that. But you're allowed to transmit HD. You can transmit sub-channels, you know, you might be on 12, 12.1, 12.2. You can add more SD programs, or as much as you can cram in and compress into 19.39 megabits and transmit it over the air. So that in itself worked well. It was a great way to go digital in the early days. It gave you good robustness. It works well under high noise conditions and so forth. You're all familiar with that. Very easy to receive, generally speaking. But it had some limitations. You know, there are other standards in the world like DVB-T, DVB-T2, and ISDB-T, some Chinese modulations now that use different types of modulation systems. Basically, they're all OFDM. And the advantages of OFDM we'll get to in a moment, but the main advantages are things that enable you to do mobile reception more easily and distributed transmission or single frequency networks a lot more easily. And those are two huge advantages. So there was an HSC 2 that added some features to HSC 1, but the problem with that was you're still stuck with the same basic RF modulation parameters, 19.39 megabits, same payload, data rates, and so forth. So the big jump here is the, you know, revolutionary change, I would like to say, is HSC 3. HSC 3 is OFDM-based. It's somewhat similar in many respects to something called DVB-T2, which is already second generation DVB-T, which had a lot of capability, lots of different payloads, data rates, robustness settings, multiple physical layer pipes, which enable you to transmit multiple programs or data streams with different corrections or different settings, depending on the type of receiving devices to be used and so forth. So there's a lot of changes that have come with HSE3. The main difference here, the main disadvantage with using HSE3, it's not backwards compatible. You know, so you probably already know this, but any TV set you have today is not going to pick it up. So you have to at least buy a converter box. So one of the key differences that was mentioned by Christine this morning is that the peak-to-average power ratio of 8 VSB is very close to 6 dBs. It's not exactly 6. It would depend a little bit on how you measure it and over what period of time and how often the peaks go over that. But they do tend to get clipped somewhat by the transmitter because the transmitter has amplifiers in it that can't pass more than a certain level of RF. They will just clip off the signal. Sometimes it's soft clipping, sometimes it's hard, but the transmitter will limit that. So the problem you might have with a TV transmitter that basically is set to have a maximum peak RF level, of, let's say it's 10 kilowatts, the average power would be 6 dBs below that for HSC1, 8 VSB. If I convert that transmitter to HSC 3.0, I can't raise the peak power. I'll have to lower the average power. The reason for that is that there's a difference in the peak-to-average ratio. It's around 8 dBs, again, and I'll get to how we measure that in a moment. So that's a big difference. The other question is, how much power do I need for HSC3? And that's kind of like a tricky question. We get asked it a lot because we make transmitters, and we have customers that want to know how to plan for the future. In some cases, you just have to make an educated guess. And I'll get to some of the reasoning and how people think about what they might do in the future in a moment. So how much power? Well, it depends. You're trying to replicate today's service. I'm pretty sure most of you would want to replicate your service area, coverage area. But how was that defined? You know, signal strength, that's one thing. Can the viewer receive it? How did it receive it? You know, rooftop antenna, over here to rooftop antenna might be how everything's calculated today. But if I'm adding in some other receiving devices, like a mobile device this big or slightly bigger, like a tablet or a phone, some indoor reception becomes possible because you have mostly kids that like to watch small screens. I like big screens myself, but if you're watching a small screen and you're inside the basement of your house, how much signal do you think is getting through all those walls and down the basement? Not much. So you have a problem with that. So you might need to think about how you're going to get power to those devices. And it's not just the big transmitter anymore. This is where things like single frequency networks come into play. So I'll talk about it in a moment. The other thing is, what type of programming are you trying to transmit? You know, if you're just going to replicate today's service, you can do that pretty easily with 3.0, but you're not using the full feature set that's available to you. You might want to add ultra-high definition 4K, which uses up a bit more bandwidth or data payload. You might want more services on there, lots more SD or HD programming to different types of devices. And by playing with certain parameters, you can play with the way that signal propagates and how far out you get. So the ERP could be any number from today's to something smaller to something bigger, which the government probably won't let you do because, you know, you have interference and other things. So the general thinking today is to at least try to replicate the ERP for the average power level that your station is licensed for today. That's what consultants have been telling me anyway. So when I talk about payload and robustness, the chart here shows payload along the bottom. And then there's different constellations. You see that there's a very large constellation at the bottom, 4096 QAM. So that has a lot of constellation data points that all have to be received and decoded by the receiver for the signal to come out looking the way it went in. The problem with that is it requires a very high carrier-to-noise ratio to correctly decode that. I think it's over 30 dBs. It's some big number, like 32 dBs. That's very difficult to achieve in real world, where you've got interference and reflections and noise and other things adding to that signal that removes some of that robustness. So I don't think that's a very practical end of the chart to run, even though somebody may say, oh, I need 55 megabits because I'm going to run 4 UHDs or something crazy like that, plus some other data. So I've actually shown on this chart where HSC1 is. It's fixed with a black dot on the chart. 19.39 megabits per second. You need about 15 dBs carrier to noise to receive that. You need, actually it's 15.2, I think is the exact number, receiver to correctly decode that. You cannot move that around. That is the payload. If I take that same 15 dB carrier to noise and just go to the right, because of better error correction, better modulation characteristics, we can actually immediately increase the payload to something around 26 megabits per second without losing anything. The same receiver, signal strength, rooftop antenna or indoor antenna, whatever you were using at that point that was working with HSC1 would also work with HSC3, but doing nothing to the power or changing other parameters around. You can get to 26, but you might want to go a little higher. So I've drawn some red lines, which might show a reasonable range that the most likely use case would be. The reason I show some higher payloads, there are many people wanting to do this, and you're going to think, well, that signal just drops off. How am I going to get that carrier to noise really good at the fringe of my service area? And that's where you might think about single frequency networks in the future. You can increase that signal strength towards the outskirts or the edges of your coverage area, perhaps. So peak to average ratio, I'm going to go through this quickly, but 6 dBs versus 8 dBs, things are going to look different. We did some measurements, and this is where we look at cumulative distribution factors, and there are percentages along the bottom, on the vertical chart here, and you can see over some percentage of time the peaks go over some level. It depends on over what percentage of time, as Christine mentioned, every now and again, statistically, the peaks all add up, all these carriers add up, and you get a very high peak RF signal. But if you use 0.1%, which is a fairly standard measurement, some people use 0.01%, but if I use 0.1%, you can look at the 8 VSB side, and you'll see that the PAR, and this is the output of the transmitter after the mask filter, 6.06 dBs. So that's where the rounded off number of 6 dBs came from. If I take the same equipment and run it with OFDM signals, in this case it would be HSC3, this number's 8.01 dBs. So it's very similar, using the same CCDF, the same cumulative distribution factor. So that's where those two numbers come from, courtesy of Mr. Joseph Sear, one of my colleagues that took the pictures for me. Thanks, Joe. To draw that diagrammatically, let's assume you have a transmitter, as I mentioned earlier, that's peak power limited. Cannot raise it, because what would happen if I turn the power up to get the average power back up for the OFDM signal after I've converted it? The peaks just clip off. What would that do to your signal? Well, what happens is the amplifier, because it's clipping, creates artifacts, intermodulation distortion. Intermodulation distortion close in, which would be the third order intermodulation distortion, will give you higher shoulders, all right, adjacent channel RF levels that's could be filtered out with good filtering, but you don't want to be too high, because the filter doesn't work right at the channel edge. It's slightly rolled off at the edge, so you've got to be careful with that. It also would destroy the quality of the signal in terms of SNR, signal to noise ratio. Okay? Which today you're using SNR today, tomorrow it will be MER, modulation error ratio, which can also be converted to EVM. So we want modulation error ratios to be 34 dBs or better, just for the quality of the signal, because other factors will make reception more difficult. You might as well start with a really clean signal. So we want the MER to be really good, starting point. So you can't just crank power up to bring the average power up. So what do you have to do? Well, you can redesign the transmitter so it has more peak power handling headroom, in this case 2 dBs more peak headroom, and if it's working in HSC1, the average power is whatever it is, X. When it's converted to HSC3, the average power can be the same, but the peaks have gone up by 2 dBs. But you haven't reached that threshold of the amplifier clipping. At least you're not hitting it hard. If there's a little bit of clipping, what I would call soft clipping, can be corrected by adaptive pre-correction that's built into the system. There is something called peak to average ratio, or peak to average power ratio reduction. Christine mentioned this also. So built into the standard is something called ACE, Active Constellation Extension, or TR, which is also another technique which you can actually use to expand the constellation. So it kind of, as it goes through the modulation, there's some algorithms in there that help you reduce the overall transmitted peak to average power ratio. It sounds good in practice, but as Christine pointed out earlier, No one's actually doing it today. And this is where it's actually mentioned in the physical layer protocol for HSC3. There's some wording in there that talks about it. But it does say there's some reference outlines and some reference algorithms that are mentioned in there that could be used for tone reservation, which is the TR or the active constellation extension. We haven't done it yet. It's quite complicated. We will probably develop our own techniques to do very similar things that will be able to reduce the peak to average power ratio slightly, but I'm not expecting it to change it much, just a little bit. So, the summary on peak to average power ratio, the 2 dB increase in PAR at the transmitter output will occur when switching at the moment because we haven't developed any good techniques for reducing that 8 dBs lower and still maintain signal performance. So the peak energy can increase. Now, another problem with it is there's something here called the Gibbs phenomena. When you pass a modulation envelope that's varying in amplitude up and down fairly quickly, you go through a tuned circuit like a mask filter, it can cause ringing artifacts that can actually increase the peaks. It's like when you hit a square wave into an LC filter of some sort, you get some ringing response. You get the same type of thing here. It can be mathematically calculated. There's a link on the bottom here that tells you where you can go and read about it. I don't have time to try to explain it, and it's quite complicated. But this could increase the peaks even more over the 8 dBs slightly, maybe a dB or so. So there's a little bit of, you know, a little bit of headroom needed over that 8. And I'm recommending about 10 dBs. I've talked to several RF equipment manufacturers that make passive components like dielectric ERI and others. And their numbers have been 8, 9, 10 dBs. But 10 dBs, to me, is a pretty good safe number. So if you're looking at transmission line power ratings for transition to 3.0, don't just look at the average power. Look at peak power, peak voltages, other things. My recommendation, call the supplier of the transmission line, the filter, the antenna, and get some feedback from them to make sure what you've got will work in the future, or if you have to replace it. Christine talked about vertical polarization as well. Is there any benefit? Dielectric actually produced this slide some time ago. I think this was back in ATSC1 early days, but you know, the same thing is important here as what was predicted back then. If you try to improve reception to indoor or mobile types of receivers, even to vehicles, we have whip antennas on that don't intercept too much of the horizontal polarization of the waveform. Some of the vertical in there. It's good to have some of each, so you want some horizontal and vertical components. Is it necessary to go full CP, circular polarization? I'd love to say yes, because we can sell you a transmitter that's exactly twice as big as the one you're using today. But I think you can get by with somewhere between 20 and 35-40%. And around 30% V-pole seems to be the typical request that we're getting at the moment. So there's something to look forward to when thinking about adopting 3.0. Do I need to increase power just to add some vertical polarization to my radiated signal from the antenna? So not only do you have to talk to the antenna manufacturer, you have to talk to the transmitter manufacturer as well, and make sure that all of your system components in between are rated for that extra power if you need it. So the RF plant considerations, let's look at all the individual components. It's not just the transmitter. And there's other bits and pieces in here. My diagram's somewhat simplistic, but it shows a fairly typical string of components from where the, in this case, IP transport comes in. Okay, you have an IP signal feeding the exciter. It modulates it. The exciter is a very, very low power transmitter that creates the signal. In our case, it's only 100 milliwatts. So it needs to be amplified, goes through a power amplifier. And within that transmitter will be a low-pass filter to get rid of harmonics, primarily. After that, you'll have a mask filter, which is tuned to your specific channel, potentially a combiner if you're combining multiple channels together, or you have two transmitters in parallel, you would have a combiner of some sort. RF line, oh, sorry, missed the patch panel and dummy load, RF line and an antenna. I would say that all of those items should be looked at. You cannot assume that every one of those will work properly when converting from 1.0 to 3.0, primarily because of peak to average power ratio. Peak voltages and peak powers are different if you're maintaining the same average power or even increasing the average power, in which case you will also have to look at the average power ratings. So people buying repack transmitters today or at least looking at quotations for them and thinking about what they should buy for repack purposes when they're changing frequencies. We're also looking at adding some additional funding that the government isn't paying for, of course, to increase the transmitter power, and potentially look at higher power versions of filters and other components, like what do I need for vertical polarization? So things to think about. So transmitter itself, let's look at that. There's some old ones and some new ones. First question I would ask if I were you looking at transmitters, thinking about buying a new one, does it have an upgrade path to 3.0? If it does, what does it entail? Do I have to physically change exciters, hardware, amplifiers? What bits and pieces have to change? The good news here is most recent transmitters built by reputable companies can easily be converted to HSC3. And I mean easily. In our case, it's a software upgrade only. The new exciters that we're manufacturing today have all the hardware you need. They have the storage, the capability of storing that modulation in the exciter and running it. We're already doing it. So the good answer for us is it's software upgrades. It's not expensive. You may want to check a few things when you're doing the upgrade, make sure the waveform's coming out properly, you test it and make sure it's working, but the basic change is software update. The other question is it big enough? I don't mean physically how big is it, how much power does the transmitter make? And will it still make that power in HSC3, or do I have to turn it down? What do I have to do there? Or do I have the capability of increasing the power? Can I add a power amplifier, or a power block, or a whole rack? And add combining and other bits and pieces to make that higher power as needed in the future. So those are good questions to be asking yourself today. Changing the topic slightly, but something inside the transmitter, very important, is what are we using for amplifiers? Everything we manufacture for television today is solid state. There have been excellent progress in solid state device technology over the last 4 or 5 years. Excellent progress. We're now buying devices that are designed specifically for UHF broadcast operation and relatively broadband operation that use LDMOS, lateral diffuse metal oxide silicon devices. In the case of the one from Amplion, the BLF-888D, it's an asymmetrical Doherty device. And Doherty is a very high efficiency technique, don't have time to fully explain it. But if you look at the two curves here, there's a red line that shows efficiency versus average power, peak power, and so forth. And there's about exactly a 6 dB difference between the operation point, the best efficiency point of the main amplifier or the average power amplifier, half of this device, as the peaking device, which is the other half of this two-device semiconductor, is 6 dB difference. The newer device, which is asymmetrical, has two different power level devices built into the same casing, and they're running at slightly different power levels. And you can extend the peak to average power ratio parameters to almost 8 dBs. And if you remember my slide about peak to average power ratio, that kind of lines up roughly with the peak to average power ratio of an 8 ATSC 3.0 signal. So you can see that by spreading the efficiency across a little bit, you're going to have a little bit more efficiency across a wider average power ratio. It'll actually have a better efficiency across that range where most of the signal is operating. Obviously, parts of the envelope go lower. It goes lower, but most of it is between the average and the peak power. So you can see you would have some advantage of going to that type of device. Moving to the mask filter, this is something that was talked about again this morning. Today's mask filters, 6-pole filters, are very common. There's a typical, that's a computer-generated frequency response and reflection characteristics of a 6-pole filter, would work for HSC3. There's no question about that. That would work. But this explains a little bit about it. You're trying to meet the same mask parameters, the same adjacent channel parameters, and so forth. But as was pointed out this morning, there's a little bit more bandwidth involved. HSC 3.0 does use more of the 6 megahertz. So if you've got adjacent channels in the same location, the same facility even, or very closely geographically located, you might want to think carefully about protecting those adjacent channels, your competitors, make sure they do the same to you. And an 8-pole filter might, in fact, be a good solution in those cases. We've talked to some consultants that are highly recommending 8-pole filters. We've sold both. We've sold 6-pole and we've sold 8-pole. It's kind of like, which way do you go today? But it does depend on your circumstances, where you're located. I talk to consultants and group together with the other broadcasters in your market and see what they're all doing and make sure you're all on the same uh, playing the same deck of cards here, because, you know, I can see this being a bit of a challenge in the future. Somebody goes 6-pole, the other guy's 8-pole, and why didn't you do this? And, you know, you've got to be a little bit careful there. So, one thing we've done is we took a look at the mass filter bandwidths, and we look at the transmitter bandwidth itself. An AGSC1 signal has a 3 dB bandwidth with Nyquist kind of filtered roll-off that's built into this, the way it works, is 5.38 megahertz. That's the 3 dB down bandwidth of an AGSC1 signal, your 8-bit signal. AGSC3 has a maximum bandwidth when configured for 6 megahertz channel of 5.83. So take those two numbers and switch them around. So 5.38 becomes 5.83 megahertz. Again, this was mentioned this morning by Christine a little bit too, at the 3 dB down point. So you could see that if you had adjacent channels going into, for instance, a combiner, the combining becomes trickier. Now, one thing that's interesting is there are different settings. I'm sorry, that's a bit of an eye chart. There's a little table there. And I got this from the physical layer standard that the ATSC has published. There are five different settings that you can actually change the bandwidth. And I'm trying to see what the lowest one is, but it can get down very close to, 5.509 megahertz. You can actually set it on the minimum one. It's quite close to the 5.38. It's not quite as narrow, but would make the filtering and the combining of adjacent channels much easier. What's the disadvantage of setting it to 5.509 versus 5.83? You can guess. You've chopped off some of the carriers. And that would reduce the maximum payload of your signal slightly. So there's always a trade-off here, but it is doable. So that's a good advantage of the standard. It has a lot of flexibility. Power handling. So coaxial mass filters may handle the average power, but peak power and peak voltages will be greater with HSC3. So average power may be the same, or you might raise it a little bit. You'd have to look at your ratings of your filters. Typically, people buy them with some headroom. You know, we like to sell filters with some headroom, so we'll allow for some change in power later. But you need to check the peak power ratings of those filters as well. And I've done some calculations here. I won't read them out to you, but you can see that the peak voltages go up significantly. Things to look at. On coaxial filters, that becomes important. You know, maybe you should have bought one with slightly bigger coaxial sizes going in and out and inside the cavities. But they're popular, and they're easily tunable. Waveguide filters for many years were not really tunable. They were fixed, welded, glued shut. They were tuned to whatever channel you were on in the old days. No one thought about changing frequencies, did they? Not that much. So they weren't really tunable. But there are some new waveguide filters. I think Christine showed one this morning that they're getting to the market that is bigger, higher power, and it's tunable. You know, TE-101 mode. Again, it would be highly mathematical if you get into that. But some of these filters are tunable. You might pay good money for it, but you have the advantage that these can handle pretty high peak power and peak voltages as well, the waveguide filters. So there's some advantages there. Hang on. So here's a few photos just to show you that there are a wide array of filters, and the one on the left is actually a combiner with filter sections built into it from different manufacturers, and these aren't the only manufacturers. There's plenty of them around, but you know, you're probably familiar with some of those companies. So they go from very small filters for very low power stations. We sell filters that work at 150 watts up to ones that run at tens of kilowatts. So we don't make any of them. We just buy them from these and other manufacturers. What else do I need to look at inside the building? Well, you've got elbows, line, dummy loads, patch panels, things like that that need to be at least looked at. Again, hopefully everything was bought with some headroom, but probably worth checking. Check those peak voltages, peak powers. Make sure nothing needs to be changed, or you will have some unfortunate issues down the road. So in general, I think, you know, in summary for the RF line, things should be reusable in general. Tuning and matching sections will obviously need to be looked at. I've seen sites with paddle tuners. You know, it might be a row of three or four strategically spaced apart, a certain, you know, eighth of a wavelength apart or whatever. These paddles are adjusted to minimize biswar, to take into account things like patch panels, elbows, other components that have some reflections. If you're changing frequency, don't forget to have somebody change the tuning, because you will need to tune everything back out again on a new channel. It's obvious, but people seem to forget that type of thing. Mask filters, of course, have to be retuned or replaced. most cases, the newer ones can all be retuned. It's not an easy task in general. It requires some expertise, some test equipment. Some of you have it, you know, network analyzers, adapters, precision loads, and some kind of instructions to follow. I know the filter manufacturers in general have the instructions, but if you've ever done it, if you try it for the first time, it'll probably take you a lot more time than you thought it would, and will it be perfect? Maybe. I've tried it. It takes a long time. You might want to just call in the filter manufacturer or somebody from like a company like GatesAir or whoever your transmitter manufacturer is to tune it for you. It could save you time. If you're trying to do a quick changeover to HSE3 and then want to go back to 1 because you're just going through some testing phase, bear in mind that's not easy to retune back either. It's just as hard to tune to the new channel as go back to the old one. So think about that before you just assume you're going to tune it once and forget about it. Or you do all your testing without the filter and assume everything's going to work great when you retune it. So there's options there, but you have to be careful. Test load, it should work fine, right? Test loads are broadband, but a lot of these have little tuning sections in the front end of them. You know, check all that before you do, you know, before you assume everything's going to work. Antenna. All right, won't get much into that because Dielectric had an excellent presentation on antennas, but there's a situation where I wouldn't want to be in there changing antennas too much, but it would be fun. Or on top of a tall building. An existing antenna probably will work for HSE3. Christine covered it well, so I'm not going to do a lot of things. Obviously, again, check the power ratings, add the V-pole if you think you might need that for improved indoor mobile portable reception. Could be useful for HSE3, yes. Talk to the antenna supplier. Transition scenarios. So getting away from the topic of transmitters, how would you consider the best approach for switching from one modulation to the other? You know, a lot of people have tried to think of good, clever ways to do this, but you really need to stay on the air. You're not going to be given new frequencies, as far as I know. I don't think anyone's being issued a new channel, and then there aren't very many left, right? So it's going to be hard. So assuming you have to stay on whatever channel you're repacking to today for HSE3, how do you stay on the air? So one scenario is, you know, you could... Let me go to the next slide. Here we go. Two scenarios. Here we go. Single owner, two stations. Let's say you own two stations, or you're very friendly with another station that's not too competitive. You can work with them. If you own them both, it's easier. You have channel A and channel B, or channel X and channel Y. You have an HD on each one and two SDs on each one. I've simplified it. It could be some other combination of programs or audio or whatever, but you've got these running. What you could do is whatever was on channel Y, you can put onto channel X, squeeze it in there somehow. You may lose your HD programming and have to go to SD, but you could get all of your programming on one transmitter. In the meantime, you can transmit programs from both stations on the HSE3, and they can be on different, you know, different virtual channels, so it looked like two completely different stations to the viewer. They won't know what's going on. You can make it say whatever channel number you want on the receiver, can't you? So there's a scenario, and then after time, you can get all of the programming over to this one, and then you can, when there's enough receivers in the market, nobody has HSE1 receivers anymore, how many years down the road that is, you can convert both of these to 3.0 and then redistribute the programming back to the way it should be. You can optimize your parameters correctly, but this is one way to do it. The problem here is there are usually not so many instances where that would work. So something that's been suggested a couple of years back now, the lighthouse station concept. One station's the lighthouse. They take programming from everybody and compress it and get it into a 3.0 format and transmit it. But that one that took to be the lighthouse, that you have to distribute its programming to the other sites, right? The other transmitters that are sometimes competing networks, competing stations in the same market. So I'm not sure this one would go over too well in most areas, but it is a suggestion. This is kind of how it works. You start off on the left with these stations all running HSE1. One of them volunteers to be the lighthouse. That one switches over to HSE3. They upgrade the transmitter, load the software, do whatever they have to do to the antenna, do the V-pole, whatever they need. They become HSE3, and they get programming from the other stations. In this case, I've only drawn two other ones to make it simple. And their program is distributed amongst station A, B, and C. That's easy. And then you go another step. As more and more viewers start buying HSE3 receivers, set-top boxes, another station goes to be the second lighthouse, if you want, but they go on to 3.0, leaving one HSE1. Eventually, you see phase 3 is complete. Everybody's on 3.0. You're done. Sounds great. Sounds simple. I'm not sure it's going to work, but it's an idea. All right, last subject I've got is planning ahead. What can you do today to plan for tomorrow? It's pretty important, I would think, you know. If you fail to plan, you're planning to fail, right? It's one of those statements that's pretty obvious, but, you know, I have to repeat it. Determine your transition plan. Work out what will work. Work closely with the other stations, because it'd be nice to know what everyone's doing. You know, then you can sort of coordinate things better, and maybe you're going to share transmitters and sites and do antenna changes at the same time. Maybe you're going to share an antenna. I don't know. There's lots of things you could do there. You need to determine what you're going to send out for programming. It's not just programming. It's stuff. It's data. It could be all sorts of uses for HSC3. I'm not sure Mr. Baumgartner is going to cover some of that in his presentation, because he covers it and I don't, so we'll let him talk about that. But there's lots of things you can do. We have something called multiple PLPs, physical layer pipes. You can send out different modulations at the same time through this one 6 megahertz transmitter. I can have different constellations with different error corrections designed for different services. I could have a program or a constellation that's very robust, designed for something very low data rate like radio or video on demand, where you can send the files over slower if you want, or something like that. There's things you could do, and you could reach a bigger audience with that, perhaps. There's things you can do for mobile, indoor, and so forth. You can have all of these PLPs optimized correctly. So you need to think about how you're going to use that. And I think you just try something and see if it works, but because you could always change it. If it doesn't work, well, you change those settings and parameters until you get it exactly how you want it. You need to go through every item in the RF chain, the ones I've discussed. No, probably not everything, but I've covered everything pretty much from the IP transport input onwards. There are things ahead of the transmitter you're going to have to think about as well. We don't manufacture it, so I'm not the expert. I'm not going to talk about it, but you've got to get IP to the site, you know, IP, microwave link, STL, fiber, however you're going to do that. You need new compression, head end, all sorts of scheduler type equipment at the front end there, so you can run that signal properly. Remember about what I'm recommending, about a 10 dB peak power planning factor for all components in the RF chain, including the antenna. Be it 9 dBs, 10 dBs, whatever. It's going to be more than 8 dBs to be on the safe side. determine about the antenna. That's been talked about, so I won't dwell on it. If purchasing a new transmitter today, some of you might be because of repack, just check that it can be upgraded to 3.0. Everyone's going to say it can be, so the next question is, well, how do you do it? You know, so ask the questions. You know, I'm not going to do a sales pitch here, but just ask the questions and you will get answers. Do it right the first time, plan ahead. I think I'm ready for questions now, if anyone's had any. No questions, that means it was really clear, right? Yes, this one.
Earlier in your presentation, you had a graph that showed bit rate versus signal-to-noise ratio. If I wasn't able to convert my transmitter and I had to lower my average power 2 dB, and if ATSC version 1 needs 15 dB at the receiver to decode, can I assume that my receiver now only needs 13 dB? And if that's true, how many bits do I get with 13 dB signal-to-noise?
Your receiver still needs 15. But you come down the curve 2 dB, so your coverage goes down. So you should think about that, right?
You
haven't changed the receiver, so it still needs the same.
If I, in the ATSC 3 realm, if somebody buys a new receiver,
yes,
and I can't raise my power, so my average power drops 2.
You've lost 2 dB, yes, you've lost 2 dB on
that
curve.
So if the receiver's got 2 dB less to work with, what's the bit rate I can achieve on ATSC 3?
You'd have to look at the curve and have a look at that, but you're right, you could change the bit rate. Actually, I could go back to that real quick if we've got a second. Let me see if I can find it really quickly. I can't go back, you turned me off, that's okay. Anyway, you could take the curve and you could do what you just said. You could go down 2 dBs and then draw a straight line down to where that bit rate is, and that's where you'd be on HSC 3. You may find that it's actually still higher than 19.39 megabits because there was already an improvement. Remember I said it could go from 19.39 to 26 at the same 15. So if you're right, you go down 2 dBs and move to the left on that chart, you will find it's dropped. I bet it's still over 19.3 megabits. So you're still okay. I think that's it. All right, thank you very much, everybody.